Listen to the best wrestling podcast in the world. Journey into Wrestling every other Wednesday on the Journey into Comics Network.
The following
is a Journey into Comics.
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 Network.
Network. Network.
Network.
Network.
Network.
Production.
Production.
We interrupt the Journey into Comics Network feed for this late-breaking edition of Poor News, featuring Andrew Poor.
Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to the inaugural episode of Poor News. Yes, Poor News, news that matters. Now, for those of you who are tuning in, you notice last week was a different show, and now this week is a different show. Like, what happened to the Poor Report? Where did we go? Just a fleeting, because this is the inaugural episode. The Poor Report ended on episode 50. It became a stepping stone to a different sort of podcast. I realized that I couldn't effectively do a show about two very different topics. I feel like I had need to intermix political news with entertainment news and a lot of stuff on two different ends of the spectrum, and it felt weird going from one topic to the next. It was becoming more of like a local news affiliate as opposed to a broader news network. So it had to kind of go through some changes and had to work a few things out differently, just kind of get something that I thought would be better for everyone listening. So what I decided to come up with was a Poor Entertainment, which is a version of the Poor Report, which focuses on entertainment news, things about movies, TV, music, all that fun stuff. And then Poor News, which is kind of the follow-up to the Poor Report, sticks mainly in the political current events realm, things that are more newsworthy, so to speak. There's things about what's going on in the world, things going about in the government, things about in politics, and this, that, other presidential news, everything that kind of goes into that. So now for those of you who don't care for political news, don't really care for that, they can watch Poor Entertainment or listen to Poor Entertainment and get that kind of thing. And then Poor News, like people who enjoyed what Poor Report is doing, can keep listening to Poor News and we get some in the similar vein to that, and then don't have to worry about any of the entertainment fluff news that they don't care about. So it kind of gets the best of both worlds, and hopefully there's still some of you, like myself, that like both sides of the news, and they can just tune in week to week like they did before and get all of that in a more thorough topic. And sometimes allowing a two-week gap between each iteration of the show allows some more topics and news to develop, so I'm not giving you late-breaking news with no follow-up, like, oh, this is what it is, and then have no follow-up. Now, giving 2 weeks, I can still give you some late-breaking news, but I can give you some news that's more seasoned. It's allowed things to develop more and be like, oh, well, this is what came out last week. Since then, this has happened, and we can kind of move forward that way. So it gives me a chance to kind of bring you more specific news, better news, so to speak. So I definitely thank you guys for tuning into that. And before I really jump into some news I want to talk about today, there's the main overarching thing I want to talk about today was on extremes. With every person out there, with every culture, with every society, we have an issue with, there's always an extreme. There's always extreme types of people. There's always extreme organizations. There's always extreme facets of things. Like, for example, take into account what we saw last year with these alt-right rallies and people that were going above and beyond what shouldn't be done. They were protesting and then it got violent and then there was counter-protests and those got violent and then Trump came out and said both sides did things bad, both sides had things that were good, all of that. And that kind of shows the extreme of what we're talking about. Like, you see extremes like, for example, a lot of people associate extremes like in the Middle East with soldiers and the fighters and all that over there are being, they're fighting like radical, like jihadists or radical Muslims and all that. And people are seeing how that encompasses everyone over there, for example. And that's not necessarily the case. That's not really the case at all. There's people over there that are just like us. They're just going about their day-to-day life. And then there's people that are out there being extreme and causing problems and all of that. And then it creates negative connotations. Now there's the extreme of people with immigration, people that are abusing the system. They're bring over violence and drugs and stuff, and that's the kind of the blanket thing gets put over all of the immigrants coming in. There's immigrants that are coming in, they're just seeking a better life, but they're being lumped into the same category. And it's kind of the thing, we gotta not focus on the extremes of people. Like, there's the extreme conservatives who people think are out there to take away their rights and out there to cause havoc, and they don't care what's going on, and they just want reduced taxes for the rich, and they want big breaks for companies and all of that. And then that's the extreme side. And there's more moderate Republicans. The same thing with the Democrats. There's people that are all the way at the other end of the spectrum, the far, far left, who just want free things for everyone, and they want all of the people in the Republican to be suffered. They are the ones who hate Trump with a blind fury, and nothing anyone says to them. Like, they'll see no good thing about what Trump's doing, and there's just extremes to all facets of that, and we gotta just chill. Like, I don't get what the point is, why people need to be so upset, or why people need to categorize people to such an extreme level. Like, there's people that says all Catholic priests are evil and twisted, even though it's just a small percentage. Yes, what they did, like everything that came out in Pennsylvania and what's going on with that. And I have the letter from the Pope that came out recently that talks about there's other things now. He's kind of condemning their actions. But people see the issue with the Catholic Church and with just the horrible things going on with how they've treated young kids and boys especially, and how people say that's the reason the Catholic Church is evil, and how it's awful what these priests are doing, and all priests should be arrested and put in prison and locked up and have done to them what they've done to others. And for the ones who have done that, absolutely, there's no excuse for that. But there's a lot of priests out there. There's a lot of people in the clergy that are just regular people. People have a strong faith in God and chose to have that be the rest of their life, and they've never had any feelings like that. I've never done anything remotely close to that. But they're getting lumped in because people see the actions of one piece of a larger group as evil. It's like saying that everyone who's religious is against the Second, or not the Second Amendment, against, or isn't, is pro-life. And pro-life means they're anti-abortion. That means that you can't do something. Like, you have no control over your body. Like, that's not the case at all. Like, that's, so there's people out there that believe that people are praying for you, but they ultimately just want health and wellness and everyone to have a chance at life. They're very much pro-life in that regard, but there's always an extreme. The people who throw images of a mutilated fetus and be like, look at this, look what we're doing. Like, that's a whole nother extreme, and that's not okay either. Like, no one should be felt guilty like that. Yes, I know there's talk about, like, the Jewish guilt, the Catholic guilt, all of that. Like, no, just relax. Like, we just need to stop labeling and lumping small factions of group into making them the whole thing. Like, it's just, what I'm mainly saying is that you just need to stop taking a small group, a vocal group, and saying that is a reflection of the group as a whole. Like, not all Republicans are the Republicans that you see. They're not all like President Trump. They're not all like the high levels of the conservative, the Republican group over there. They're not all like that. The same thing we see with Democrats. Like, all Democrats aren't as an extreme as what Bernie Sanders wants us to be. Like, there's a wide range for all these groups out there, and we just need to see people individually and not lump them into these groups, into these categories. And I think if we, as soon as we do that, the sooner we'll all be better off. And with that, I'm going to kind of wrap up that segment. I'll probably edit this a little bit just because it was more of a speech than a rant. I didn't have my thoughts fully formulated, but that's the nature of a podcast. You kind of, with a new show, you kind of get the, you have to get the, kind of have to grease the wheels, grease the gears, all that, to get everything moving in the right direction. So I'm going to move from that to the news for this week, and I have a few fun topics here. Not fun per se, but, and this thing's evolved something that's been going on for a while. If you remember Trump, after he went to France with French President Macron, I believe his name was, he saw the military parade for Bastille Day and thought, I want that, I want tanks and rockets and a flyover of jets and all that, and I want that on the streets of Washington, D.C., and I can sit there and enjoy that. And then there was a cost, he was going to get it to cost like $12 million, like, oh, that's an extreme amount, that's too much money, and people were already outcrying. Then it came out that it ballooned to like, what was it, like $92 million? Which led to what we're kind of talking about now, and that involves, this is an article from Fox News, which says, Trump blames D.C. as military parade plans unravel over costs. So the cancellation of President Donald Trump's Veterans Day parade came swiftly when senior White House and Pentagon leaders saw the estimated $92 million price tag play out in the public, setting off a chaotic volley of tweets and accusations between the president and the mayor of the nation's capital. I just kind of jumping out of the article. I so feel bad for the mayor of Washington, D.C. They're not even the highest ranking official in their town, city, whatever you want to call it. There's so many people above them because it houses the leadership of the United States. So it kind of sucks that no one really knows you exist until something like this happens. So the drama that unfolded Thursday and Friday also highlighted, not for the first time, a disconnect between the Pentagon and the White House when it comes to turning some of Trump's more mercurial ideas into reality. While Defense Secretary Jim Mattis dismissed the price estimate for the parade as fiction, likened the report of it as the work of someone who had been smoking pot, okay, Trump wasn't denying the projected costs. He was lashing out at Washington, D.C. politicians he claimed were to blame for the sky-high prices. When asked to give us a price for holding a great celebratory military parade, they wanted a number so ridiculously high that I canceled it. Never let someone hold you up, Trump tweeted. He held out in hope of holding the parade next year instead, and said this year he would travel to Paris for events, making the centennial of the end of the fighting in World War I, which falls on Veterans Day, November 11th. Now we can buy some more fighter jets, even though I think fighter jets are more than $92 million. So, whatever that statement has to be. Despite Trump blaming municipal authorities for the high estimates, the bulk of the cost was the $50 million Pentagon portion that would cover military aircraft, equipment, personnel, and other support. The remaining $42 million would cover costs borne by the city and other agencies and largely involve security costs. Obviously, when you have a parade that large, there's a lot of moving pieces that need to be accounted for. Obviously, you have to count transportation of all the soldiers and equipment that needs to be brought there. You have to secure the streets. The same thing. It's the inauguration, but to a larger extreme because you have a lot more military personnel present. The Republican president's finger pointed set off a social media spat with D.C.'s Democratic Mayor Muriel Bowser. She shot back on Twitter Friday that she was the one who finally got through to the reality star in the White House with the realities. 21.6 million of parades, events, demonstrations in Trump America. Sad. District of Columbia officials called the price gouging charged by Trump patently false. The city official said the 21.6 million estimate of the cost the city would incur was their best stab at it. So they did not know what the exact route would be or how long it would last. The official, who wasn't authorized to discuss the matter publicly and spoke on condition of anonymity, said there has been little interaction between the Pentagon and a few details provided. Trump said he went to a military parade in Washington after he attended France's Bastille Day celebration in the center of Paris last year. Several months later, Trump praised the French parade, saying, "We're going to have to try and top it." It was a demand that drew criticism not just from Trump's political opponents, but some Republicans too. As the Pentagon began planning for the U.S. version, the cost became a politically charged issue, as did the prospect of streets in the nation's capital being churned up by tank threats. Yeah, those tanks are not that exactly light, and I'm pretty sure those roads, some are very old, and they probably can't handle the weight of some of those tanks on them. According to officials familiar with unfolding events, senior Pentagon leaders were briefed Wednesday about the parade costs, but officials said the estimates were still preliminary, so were not submitted to Mattis or General Joseph Dunford, chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. The official spoke on condition of anonymity to discuss private meetings and conversations. When details came out publicly Thursday, senior White House officials, including Chief of Staff John Kelly, were angry about the $92 million amount, which is more than triple their early estimates of $10 million to $30 million by the White House budget director. It's not clear when Trump was told, but the order to cancel the parade came quickly and was made by the end of the workday. The Pentagon announced the decision just before 8 p.m. Throughout the day, multiple U.S. officials had confirmed the $92 million estimate that was put together by the Interagency Parade Planning Group, and Pentagon officials did not push back or at the point suggesting the reporting was wrong. So when asked by the price Thursday evening, Mattis exhorted the media and said he had seen no such estimate. "I'm not dignifying the number, $92 million, with a reply. I will discount that, and anybody who said that number, I almost guarantee one thing. They probably said, 'I need to stay anonymous, no kidding, because you look like an idiot.' And number two, whoever wrote it needs to get a better sources. I'll just leave it at that," Mattis told reporters traveling with him. Really, when you have to kind of attack the media for that kind of thing, just say, if it wasn't that amount, give a proper value. When you just say, that's not right, without providing a backup, that's just saying, well, then what is right? It looks like you're just trying to hide what the actual cost is. He said, "Whoever leaked the number to the press was probably smoking some that is legal in my state, but not in most." Reference to his home state of Washington, where marijuana use is legal. Well, at least he thought that Washington is legal in the state of Washington. So, did I say Washington is legal? Marijuana is legal in the state of Washington. Mattis's comments came hours after the estimates was made public and not long after the cancellation decision was made, giving his staff plenty of time to ensure he was made aware of the planning estimate's accuracy. One reason for the political sensitivity was that Trump himself had boasted that the cancellation of a major military exercise with South Korea amid easing tensions with North Korea would save the U.S. a tremendous amount of money. The Pentagon later said the Korea drills, which typically take place every August, would have cost $14 million and amount dwarfed by the estimated cost of the parade. Okay. The cancellation of those drills, like Trump's demands for a parade, initially caught the Defense Department unawares. Mattis was also widely viewed as being unenthusiastic about the president's plan to set up a space force as a new branch of the military, but as in other cases, he has towed the line of the commander-in-chief. I don't get it. He's a military man. You should be able to stand up to him, but when you're the president of the United States, not a lot of people can stand up to you and live to tell the tale. The parade was expected to include troops from all five armed services, the Army, Navy, Air Force, Marine Corps, and Coast Guard, as well as units in period uniforms representing earlier times in the nation's history. It was also expected to involve a number of military aircraft flyovers, which can carry significant costs in personnel, aircraft, and support. A Pentagon planning memo released in March said the parade would feature a heavy air component, likely including older vintage aircrafts. It is also said there would be wheeled vehicles only, no tanks. Consideration must be given to minimize damage to local infrastructure. Big heavy tanks could tear up the streets in the District of Columbia, like I said before. And kind of moving from that to more Trump-related news, and that involves Trump talking to Fox and Friends host for opinion on veteran care during the meeting with VA chief. Now, this is an older article, but I kind of missed it on the Poor Report whenever it came out back in March. But it's very interesting nonetheless. President Trump dialed in a Fox and Friends co-host to weigh in on legislation about veterans' health care during a meeting with Veterans Affairs Secretary David Shulkin. Shulkin and Trump were discussing legislation to reform veterans' health care during an Oval Office meeting last week when Trump reportedly called Fox and Friends co-host Peter Hegseth to get his opinion. And this is where the article kind of goes from, like, what? To, okay, that kind of makes sense, but still weird. So Hegseth is a veteran and former executive director of Action Group for Vets for Freedom, and was among those considered to be VA secretary under Trump. Trump is a frequent viewer of Fox News, including The Morning Show. Sources told Axios that the phone call put Shulkin in an uncomfortable spot as Hegseth is pushing for more intense reforms and interviewed for Shulkin's job, which is just weird because he's your secretary of Veteran Affairs, and you call a news host, a news anchor, and basically, like, what would you do in that situation? Like, I'm the guy you hired, not the other guy that interviewed. Like, I'm in a weird spot here. It's like, did you want that guy? You should have hired him. Like, what's the deal here? So, I don't know. That's just weird. I feel like you hired them for a reason. Use them. You don't need to call outside help, especially someone who's in the news media. That's just weird. And kind of staying with more Trump news, which is a lot of what I'm talking about today. There's only a few things I'm talking about. Former presidential candidate Bernie Sanders, and then the Pope, and then Trump's wife, Melania, which still kind of ties into Trump news. So the President Trump attacks reports on White House counsel's cooperation with Mueller. In a series of tweets over the weekend, President Trump responded to a story published in the New York Times that detailed extensive cooperation between White House counsel Donald McGahn and the inquiry by special counsel Robert Mueller into obstruction of justice and possible collusion between the Trump campaign and Russia. In a tweet Saturday night, Trump said he allowed and encouraged McGahn's cooperation with the special counsel. In addition, we readily gave over 1 million pages of documents, most transparent in history, Trump wrote. Sunday morning, Trump continued tweeting, affirming he had nothing to hide. The New York Times reported that McGahn spoke with Mueller's team about Trump's firing of the FBI director James Comey and his push for Attorney General Jeff Sessions to claim oversight of the inquiry, and Trump's attempt to fire Mueller. His interviews with Mueller's team of investigators totaled 30 hours. Trump's team of personal lawyers had initially instructed McGahn to cooperate with Mueller with the goal of bringing the investigation to an end as quickly as possible, and with the premise that the president had nothing to hide. According to the New York Times, McGahn became increasingly concerned about Trump's encouragement of his interviews with the special counsel and feared Trump was setting him up to take the fall for possible illegal acts. The New York Times reports, Mr. McGahn and his lawyer, William A. Burke, could not understand why Mr. Trump was so willing to allow Mr. McGahn to speak freely to the special counsel and feared Mr. Trump was setting up Mr. McGahn to take the blame for any possible illegal acts of obstruction, according to people close to him. So he and Mr. Burke devised their own strategy to do as much as possible to cooperate with Mr. Mueller to demonstrate that Mr. McGahn did nothing wrong. While McGahn says he never saw Trump go beyond his legal authorities, the Times says he gave investigators a mix of information both damaging and favorable to the president. It remains unclear if McGahn answered questions on collusion between the Trump campaign and Russia. Michael Beschloss, a presidential historian, says McGahn's cooperation with the special counsel is reminiscent of John Dean, the White House counsel under President Nixon, who was eventually fired by Nixon during the Watergate scandal. Beschloss told the New York Times The Sure has echoes of Richard Nixon's White House counsel, John Dean, who in 1917 feared that Nixon was setting him up as the fall guy for Watergate and secretly gave investigators crucial help while still in his job. On Saturday, Dean tweeted that McGahn is doing the right thing. In an interview with Slate, Dean said, "Don McGahn is doing exactly the right thing, not merely to protect himself, but to protect his client, and his client is not Donald Trump. His client is the office of the president. That is one of the things that was cleared up as a result of Watergate. The American Bar Association reissued a code of ethics and dealt directly with representation of an organization and who the client is. And the client in this instance would not be the man who holds the office, but the office itself. And that is a huge difference." Which is true. The White House counsel is the presidency as a whole, not just the president currently in power. McGahn's lawyer William Burke gave a statement to NPR on McGahn's reaction to the Times report. "President Trump thought through counsel declined to assert any privilege over Mr. McGahn's testimony, so Mr. McGahn's answered the special counsel's team's question fulsomely and honestly, as any person interviewed by federal investigators must." In a statement to the Times, White House Press Secretary Sanders said, "The president and Don have a great relationship. He appreciates all the hard work he's done, particularly his help and expertise with the judges and the Supreme Court." In an interview with NBC News Meet the Press on Sunday, Giuliani said he has reservations about Trump sitting for an interview with Mueller. Giuliani said, "Look, I'm not going to be rushed into having him testify so that he gets trapped in perjury, and when you tell me that, you know he should testify because he's going to tell the truth and he shouldn't worry. Well, that's so silly because somebody's version of the truth, not the truth. Because it's somebody's version of the truth, not the truth." And then Todd says, "Truth is truth." Todd said, "No, it isn't truth. Truth isn't truth," Giuliani said. "The President of the United States says, I didn't," and then he kind of trails off, and then Todd said, "Truth isn't truth." This is going to become a bad meme. Which I think is kind of funny that that the host of Meet the Press said, this is going to become a bad meme, which is really kind of apparent of what's going on in the White House right now. Giuliani continued, "Donald Trump says, I didn't talk about Flynn with Comey. Comey says, you did talk about it, so tell me what the truth is." Trump's personal legal team has urged the special counsel to wrap up its investigation by the midterms election this fall, and Trump has maintained his innocence through the duration of the inquiry called the Mueller investigation a quote-unquote witch hunt. Which I'm just saying, I think one thing I don't quite get is why he can't just stop talking, just let it go. The thing is, it keeps staying in the public consciousness. He keeps bringing it up and saying, "I'm innocent. This is a witch hunt. This is not. There's no collusion. I did nothing wrong," and more to that effect. And he keeps saying it every single day. If you scream at a wall loud enough, you're not going to become innocent by it. He could be innocent, but he's just not letting it go. He's just keeps claiming and trying to belittle the group and trying to say Mueller and his team of Democrats and all, they should be investigating Crooked Hillary and all this. Like, just stop. I don't get why he has to go to all this trouble and all of this just to be trying to present. Like, it's just he fears. I think he's afraid and he's just lashing out. And I kind of slightly just kind of rushed over it in that the whole thing about the truth isn't truth. That Giuliani said. Giuliani's been in hot water since he became at office. He's the whole thing about saying the other Trump's other lawyer was a good guy and then kind of turned like flip-flopping on him later once that guy was in hot water. So Rudy Giuliani, President Donald Trump's attorney, said Sunday that the truth isn't truth when explaining that he won't let special counsel Robert Mueller rush Trump into testifying because he doesn't want investigators to trap the president into a lie. Where I want to say, like, if you have nothing to hide, then you shouldn't have to worry about being trapped in a lie. Just speak. Like, when you tell me that you know he should testify because he's going to tell the truth and he shouldn't worry, well, that's silly because it's somebody's version of the truth, not the truth. And then when he said truth isn't truth, or when he said truth is truth, when he said no, it isn't truth. Truth isn't truth. The President of the United States says I didn't. Trails off again, like I said in the other article. And I'm not going to go into the whole bad meme thing. So, this isn't the first time in recent days Giuliani has spoken about the truth and facts this way. During an appearance on CNN's Cuomo primetime on Tuesday evening, Giuliani told CNN, Chris Cuomo, the facts are in the eye of the beholder. If fact-checking is anything, we've never had anybody with the level of mendacity that he has. Not even close. It's in the eye of the beholder. No, facts are not in the eye of the beholder. Yes, it is. Yes, they are. Nowadays, they are. Giuliani asserted. The president's outside legal team for the special counsel investigation, which is headed up by Giuliani, replied to Mueller's proposal for terms of possible presidential testimony earlier this month. But the former New York mayor wouldn't disclose the details of the team's response. Trump has said he is willing to speak with Mueller's team, but his legal team has expressed opposition to the possibility because they believe the special counsel investigators could take what Trump says, if it differs from what others have laid out, as a lie. They have two pieces of evidence, Giuliani said on Todd on Sunday morning, explaining his stance. Trump says, "I didn't tell them." Another guy says that he did say it, which is the truth. Maybe you know because you're a genius. On Sunday afternoon, former FBI Director James Comey appeared to respond to Giuliani's truth isn't truth comment via Twitter. His tweet says, "Truth exists and truth matters. Truth has always been the touchstone of our country's justice system and political life. People who lie are held accountable. If we are untethered to truth, our justice system cannot function and a society based on the rule of law dissolves." Giuliani has been speaking about Comey in the news lately. Last week, Giuliani told CNN's Jake Tapper that if the president sits down for questioning by Special Counsel Robert Mueller, Trump will say he never discussed easing up on a probe of former National Security Advisor Flynn with Comey. And it's more of him just walking back what he says. There's another article in Politico, which is basically this kind of the same thing. President Donald Trump's lawyer originally tried to walk back his statement over the weekend that truth is a truth, writing on Twitter that it wasn't meant to be taken as pontification of moral theology. Giuliani made waves on NBC, responding to New York Times report the president's outside legal team was not aware of the extent to which Rathaus counsel Don McGahn cooperated in special counsel Robert Mueller's Russia investigation during the 30 hours of interview he sat for. His words, his words taken in the vein of counselor to the president Kellyanne Conway's much-mocked alternative facts argument from last year quickly caught fire online. A day later, Giuliani sought to clear the air. My statement was not meant as pontification on moral theology, but one referring to the situation where two people made precisely contradictory statements, the classic he said, she said puzzle. Sometimes further inquiry can be revealed the truth, other times it doesn't. Giuliani often acts as surrogate for the president, appearing on television in his capacity as Trump's lawyer to counter news reports about Mueller's probe. The president has long complained about the special counsel investigation, bringing it a witch hunt stacked with angry Democrats, even though Mueller himself is a registered Republican. And that's really all I want to talk about. That the whole thing with truth is truth. Like, the statement of truth isn't truth is kind of ridiculous. I understand kind of the point you're trying to make. Two people can remember the same event slightly differently. Does that mean that either side is wrong? It's kind of gray. There's usually the only thing that can be determined as fact is if I say one thing and someone says something else that they said I said, if I have a recording or I have proof or I have some kind of document that proves it's not a he said, she said thing, then we're fine. But if someone's under oath testifies and says one thing and then President Trump gets interviewed and says something else, you can't just say that, oh, because his statement's different than theirs, that he's the one lying. It could be the other person. That's the thing. But it's just the way he's saying it that's causing so much problems. I feel like it just goes back to the thing of just be honest. Just, if you're not doing anything wrong, is be as honest as you can, and this will all get wrapped up in no time. Agree to be interviewed tomorrow, the next week, whenever. Just sit down, answer your question, say you have 3 hours, go. And then that's it. But I don't know. And then comes the thing, I kind of want to move on from what this whole Mueller investigation and Trump and all that stuff with Twitter and everything, to another thing that I think is another thing that's kind of wrong with the media right now, and that involves kind of clickbaity articles. I fall victim to it too. Whenever I'm scrolling through the news and I see a headline, I'm like, oh, what's that about? And then I click through it, and then it's like, oh, that's a little crazy. So here's an article that I saw when I was kind of trying to gather articles to talk about on this week's show. And it said, Trump is nominating unqualified judges at an unprecedented rate. And I was like, okay, what's this about? And then it kind of got into the more of it, and it's not even, doesn't seem as bad. So President Trump has nominated more unqualified judicial appointees than any other president so quickly into his first term. A whopping 4 out of 58, according to the nation's preeminent legal group. The American Bar Association Standing Committee of the Federal Judiciary, which has been evaluating judicial appointees since the 1950s, it says 53 of Trump's 58 nominees and found 4 not qualified. It's certainly unprecedented, says Carl Tobias, a professor of the University of Richmond Law School, an expert in judicial nominations. The Republican-led Senate Judiciary Committee has already approved 3 of the 4 unqualified judges who are awaiting a simple majority confirmation vote in the Senate. Majority Leader Mitch McConnell has indicated he will push through the Trump nominees because he's going to do whatever Trump wants because he wants to stay in power as long as possible. Next worthy of Trump's season getting his unqualified nominees out to the bench, the core of the federal judicial process will be hollowed out. I hope he won't have any more unqualified nominees. It's a bad practice, Tobias said. If the Senate approves these nominees, it would undermine justice in the federal courts. The ABA's 15-member standing committee on the federal judiciary evaluates would-be judges on three qualifications: integrity, professional competence, and judicial temperament. Its stated objective is to assist the White House in assessing whether such individuals should be nominated to the federal judiciary. Committee members then rank nominees as either well-qualified, qualified, and not qualified. A nominee is not qualified, he or she does not meet the committee's standards with respect to one or more of the evaluation criteria. Since the Eisenhower administration, the ABA Standing Committee has ranked prospective judicial candidates before they are officially nominated for the position. The presiding administration then nominates candidates deemed qualified by the group. Since President Dwight Eisenhower, only George W. Bush and Trump opted for a different approach, nominating judges regardless of the ABA rating. We admire the ABA's goal of providing a non-politicized review of judicial nominees, but we do not intend to give any professional organization special access to our nominees, White House Counsel Donald McGahn said in March. In response, ABA President Linda Klein said that the ABA's rankings are a public good that should not be relegated to a footnote in a candidate's nominations. Over the years, the Standing Committee's work has done much to instill public confidence and trust in the judiciary, she wrote. The last time the ABA Standing Committee doled out its lowest ranking before Trump was in 2006 when the Bush administration put forth Michael Wallace for the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals. Wallace was Bush's seventh and last judicial nominee deemed unqualified by the group. In the next 10 years, the committee reviewed more than 600 candidates for federal judicial posts, all of whom were deemed qualified for the bench. But that streak was broken in October when the ABA ranked Trump's nominees Charles Goodwin unqualified. A month later, three more of Trump's nominees, Leonard Graz, Holly Teeter, and Brett Talley, received the same ranking. To put that into perspective, there were only seven nominees deemed unqualified during President George W. Bush's 8 years in office. Trump is more than halfway there 11 months into his term. Teeter and Talley were recently approved by the Senate Judiciary Committee, marking the first time in nearly 20 years that the committee has approved the nomination of someone declared unqualified by the ABA. Goodwin and Graz are waiting to be confirmed. Talley's nomination was particularly striking, better known as the right-wing blogger. Talley is just 10 years out of law school and he has never tried a case. It's also been reported that Talley has a fervent interest in investigating and writing about paranormal activities and appears to have defended the Ku Klux Klan in an online forum. It's also been recently revealed that Talley is married to the White House Counsel's Chief of Staff, a potential conflict issue he did not disclose during his Senate judiciary hearing. Grass senior counsel and Hush Blackwell LLP was nominated to become a judge in the Eighth Circuit in August. 2 months later, the ABA Standing Committee unanimously ranked Graz as unqualified with one abstention. In a statement to the Senate Judiciary Committee, Parn Breesnahan, head of the ABA Standing Committee, said that many of Graz's colleagues in Nebraska worried about his ability to preside without bias. Specifically, the statement ran, they expressed the view that Graz would be unable to separate his role as an advocate from that of a judge. Logans on the Judiciary Committee didn't heed the ABA's concerns. Instead, they charged the group as being biased against conservative judges. At a Senate Judiciary hearing on Wednesday, Senator Ted Cruz charged the group with being aligned with Democratic causes. The ABA today is an openly liberal advocacy group, Cruz said, citing the public position that the group has taken on abortion rights and gun control. In response, Senator Dianne Feinstein, the committee's ranking member, defended the group. I've been on this committee for 25 years now, and candidly, I have valid these opinions. If I disagree with them, that's fine, but I know I'm not a lawyer, and I know it is a group of lawyers from the most prominent association of lawyers who are doing some evaluation, she said. What are we afraid of? It should be noted that Teeter was approved of a bipartisan 19-1 vote. That's probably because Teeter received positive reviews from other federal judges she was working with in the past. The ABA Standing Committee rated her unqualified on a technicality. He was a month shy of the group's minimum standards of 12 years of professional experience. Wow, this is a long article. I'm just going to wrap it up here. This is one of those ones that kind of drew me in as like, wow, he's nominated an unprecedented amount of unqualified judges. Okay. And then it was 4 out of 58, which is roughly a little under 6%. But I understand what they're saying. Like, in George W. Bush's 8 years in office, he had 11 or... Was it 8 or 11? I can't remember what I read now. And then Trump is barely into his first term, is already about halfway there. So I get it, but it still makes it sound like all of his judges are unqualified, which is not the case. 4 out of 58, which is still a lot, but not as crazy as the article headline makes it out to be. And just to kind of wrap it up here, there's something I want to talk about. I kind of got into it during my little rant thing at the beginning of the episode, and that involves the abuse in Philadelphia with the Catholic Church. So the Vatican released a letter Monday from Pope Francis directly addressing, for the first time, the latest accusation of sexual abuse by priests. And I have the full text, which I'll read for you now. Dear colleagues and friends, if one member suffers, all suffer together with it, from 1 Corinthians 12:26. These words of St. Paul forcefully echo in my heart as I acknowledge once more the suffering endured by many minors due to sexual abuse. The abuse of power and the abuse of conscience perpetrated by a significant number of clerics and consecrated persons, crime that inflict deep wounds of pain and powerlessness primarily among the victim, but also in their family members and in the larger community of believers and non-believers alike. Looking back to the past, no effort to beg pardon and to seek to repair the harm done will ever be sufficient. Looking ahead to the future, no effort must be spared to create a culture able to prevent such situations from happening, but also to prevent the possibility of their being covered up and perpetuated. The pain of the victims and their families is also our pain, and so it is urgent that we once more reaffirm our commitment to ensure the protection of minors and of vulnerable adults. In recent days, a report was made public which detailed the experience of at least 1,000 survivors, victims of sexual abuse. The abuse of power and conscience at the hands of priests over a period of approximately 70 years. Even though it can be said that most of these cases belong to the past, nonetheless, as time goes on, we have come to know the pain of many of the victims. We have realized that these wounds never disappear and that they require us forcefully to condemn those atrocities and join forces in uprooting this culture of death. These wounds never go away. The heart-wrenching pain of these victims, which cries out to heaven, was long ignored, kept quiet or silenced, but their outcry is more powerful than all the measures meant to silence it, or sought even to resolve it by a decision that increased its gravity by falling into complicity. The Lord heard that cry and once again showed us which side he stands. Mary's song is not mistaken and continues quietly to echo throughout history. For the Lord remembers the promise he made to our fathers. He has scattered the proud in their conceit. He has cast down the mighty from their thrones and lifted up the lowly. He has filled the hungry with good things and the rich he has sent away empty. Luke 1:51-53. We feel shame when we realize that our style of life has denied and continues to deny the words we recite. With shame and repentance, we acknowledge as an ecclesial community that we were not where we should have been, that we would not act in a timely manner, realizing the magnitude and the gravity of the damage done to so many lives. We showed no care for the little ones, we abandoned them. I made my own the words of then Cardinal Ratzinger when, during the Ways of the Cross composed for Good Friday 2005, identified with the cry of pain of so many victims and exclaimed, "How much filth there is in the church, and even among those who in their priesthood ought to belong entirely to Christ. How much pride, how much self-complacency, Christ's betrayal by his disciples, the unworthy reception of his body and blood, is certainly the greatest suffering endured by the Redeemer. It pierces his heart. We can only call to him from the depths of our hearts. Kyrie eleison, Lord save us." The extent and the gravity of all that has happened requires coming to grips with reality in a comprehensive and communal way. While it's important and necessary on every journey of conversion to acknowledge the truth of what has happened, in itself, this is not enough. Today, we are challenged as the people of God to take on the pain of our brothers and sisters, wounded in their flesh and in their spirit. If in the past the response was one of omission, today we want solidarity, in their deepest and most challenging sense, to become our way of forging present and future history. And this is an environment where conflicts, tensions, and above all, victims of every type of abuse can encounter an outstretched hand to protect them and rescue them from their pain. Such solidarity demands that we in turn condemn whatever endangers the integrity of any person, a solidarity that summons us to fight all forms of corruption, especially spiritual corruption. The latter is a comfortable and self-satisfied form of blindness. Everything that appears acceptable, deception, slander, egotism, and other subtle forms of self-centeredness, for even Satan disguises himself as an angel of light. St. Paul's exhortation to suffer with those who suffer is the best antidote, because all our attempts to repeat the words of Cain, "Am I my brother's keeper?" I am conscious of the effort and work being carried out in various parts of the world to come up with the necessary means to ensure the safety and protection of the integrity of children and of vulnerable adults, as well as implementing zero tolerance the way of making all those who perpetrate or cover up these crimes accountable. We have delayed in applying these actions and sanctions that are so necessary, yet I'm confident we will help to guarantee a greater culture of care in the present and future. Together with those efforts, every one of the baptized should feel involved in the ecclesial and social change that we so greatly need. The change calls for personal and communal conversion that makes us see things as the Lord does. For St. John Paul II liked to say, if we have truly started out anew from the contemplation of Christ, we must learn to see him, especially in the faces of those who wish he wished to be identified. To see things as the Lord does, to be where the Lord wants us to be, to experience the conversion of people in his presence. To do so, prayer and penance will help. I invite the entire holy, faithful people of God to a penitential exercise of prayer and fasting, following the Lord's command. This can awaken our conscience and arouse our solidarity and commitment to a culture of care that says never again to every form of abuse. Is it possible to think of a conversion of our activity as a church that does not include the active participation of all members of God's people? Indeed, whenever we have tried to replace or silence or ignore or reduce the people of God to small elites, we end up creating communities, projects, theological approaches, spiritualities, and structures without roots, without memory, without faces, without bodies, and ultimately without lives. This is clearly seen in a peculiar way of understanding the church's authority. One common in many communities where sexual abuse and the abuse of power and conscience have occurred. Such in the case with clericalism as approach that not only nullifies the character of Christians, but also tends to diminish and undervalue the baptismal grace that the Holy Spirit has placed in the heart of our people. Clericalism, whether fostered by priests themselves or by laypersons, leaves an excision in the ecclesial body that supports and helps to perpetuate many of the evils that we are condemning today. To say no to abuse is to say an empathetic no to all forms of clericalism. It is always helpful to remember that in salvation history, the Lord saved one people. We are never completely ourselves unless we belong to a people. This is why no one is saved alone, as an isolated individual. Rather, God draws us to himself, taking into account the complex fabric of interpersonal relationships present in the human community. God wanted to enter into the life and history of a people. Consequently, the only way that we have to respond to this evil that has darkened so many lives is to experience it as a task regarding all of us as people of God. The awareness of being part of a people and a shared history will enable us to acknowledge our past sins and mistakes with a penitential openness that allows us to be renewed from within. Without the active participation of all of church's members, everybody being done to uproot the culture of abuse in our communities will not be successful in generating the necessary dynamics for sound and realistic change. The penitential dimension of fasting and prayer will help us as God's people to come before the Lord and our wounded brothers and sisters as sinners imploring forgiveness and the grace of shame and conversion. In this way, we'll come up with actions we can generate resources attuned to the gospel. For whenever we make the effort to return to the source and recover the original freshness of the gospel, new avenues arise, new paths of creativity open up, with different forms of expression, more eloquent signs and words with new meaning for today's world. It is essential that we as a church be able to acknowledge and condemn with sorrow and shame the atrocities perpetrated by consecrated persons, clerics, and all those entrusted with the missing of watching over and caring for those most vulnerable. Let us beg forgiveness for our own sins and the sins of others, as awareness of sins help us to acknowledge the errors, the crimes, and the wounds caused in the past and allow us, in the present, to be more open and committed along a journey of renewed conversion. Likewise, penance and prayer will help us to open our eyes and our hearts to the people's suffering, and to recover the thirst for power and possession that are so often the root of those evils. May fasting and prayer open our hearts to the hushed pain felt by children, young people, and the disabled, as fasting that can be make us hunger and thirst for justice impel us to walk in truth, supporting all the judicial measures that may be necessary, a fasting that shakes us up and leads us to the committed in truth and charity with all men and women of goodwill, and with society in general, combating all forms of abuse of power, sexual abuse, and the abuse of conscience. In this way, we can show clearly our calling to be a sign and instrument of communion with God and the unity of the entire human race. If one member suffers, all suffer together with it, said St. Paul. By an attitude of prayer and penance, we will become attuned as individuals and as community to this exhortation so that we may grow in the gift of compassion and justice, prevention, and reparation. Mary chose to stand at the foot of her son's cross. She did so unhesitantly, standing firmly by Jesus' side. In this way, she revealed the way she lived her entire life. When we experience the desolation caused by the ecclesial wounds, we will do well with Mary to insist more upon prayer, seeking to grow all men in love and fidelity to the church. She, the first disciples, teaches us all to disciple how we are able to halt before the suffering of the innocent without excuses or cowardice, to look to Mary to discover the model of the true follower of Christ. May the Holy Spirit grant us the grace of conversion and the interior anointing needed to express before these crimes of abuse are function and are resolved courageously to combat them. From Pope Francis in Vatican City on August 20th, 2018. Sorry for kind of going into that, reading that full letter. It was a lot longer than I anticipated it, and probably a lot longer to read. One thing, yes, I am Catholic, yes, it probably reads differently to me than it does to people who aren't religious or don't believe in organized religions or don't see the Pope as more than a figurehead of a religion that you don't believe in. So I apologize for that. I will probably put a timestamp on those who don't really want to hear me read this whole letter. But I think Pope Francis, since he's been elected, has been a more radical New Age Pope, even though he's like 70-some-odd years old. And it looks like he's going to really get rid of the root of the evil in the Catholic Church with these priests that are causing pain and suffering to kids and people that aren't in full control of their bodies and just all of that. And just, I'm hoping he stands by it. I'm hoping, he sounds like he's on the side of the victims and is not defending the Catholic Church or sweeping these events under the rug like they've done in years past. And I really hope that's the case, because it's not cool. Like, I watched the movie Spotlight, and I saw how much it is everywhere. They had, at the very end, during the credits, they had everywhere there's been cases of that. Every state was touched. Every city was touched in those states, and it's just not okay. Like I said in the beginning, like, not all priests are doing this, but enough are doing it that this is a problem, and they need to be weeded out and removed or replaced or do whatever they need to do to kind of move the Catholic Church in the right direction, because if this continues, there's going to be no Catholic Church left. With that, I'm going to move into two other quick topics. I think I'm already running probably close to an hour here. And that involves Bernie Sanders. A lot of you are big fans of Bernie Sanders. He recently won Vermont's Democratic nomination, but he's might turn it down, and here's why. So on Tuesday, voters in several states headed to the ballot box to participate in various primary races. In one of these elections, Bernie Sanders easily won Vermont's Democratic primary, taking about 95% of the vote. As it turns out, Sanders may reject his Democratic nomination, and something's actually done before. Sanders handily defeated Fulasad Aldaluila in the primary race, securing 94.5% of the vote, with 94% of the precincts reporting. But Sanders turned down the Democratic Party's nomination in previous campaigns in 2006 and 2012. Typically does it so he can run as independent in the general election. I don't know why he just doesn't run as independent in the primary, but I guess because it's a good stepping stool for him. Indeed, Sanders currently serves as an independent in the U.S. Senate and will likely run as independent again. As Time explained, legally the senator cannot appear on Vermont's ballot as both an independent and a Democrat, so he must choose one party affiliation. Sanders' campaign spokeswoman Ariana Jones told Time the senator plans to decline the Democratic nomination, saying, "This is what he has done in the past, and this is what he looks forward to happening in 2018. If he's not going to run Democratic all the way to the general, why not just be an independent all the way through? Why hide under the blanket of the Democratic Party the same way he did during the 2016 election? I'll never know." But Time also reported in past races Sanders accepted the endorsement of Vermont's Democratic Party despite rejecting the nomination. He looks to be on the track to similarly coordinate with Democrats in 2018, with Jones telling the outlet, "As he has for many campaigns, Bernie will contribute to and participate in the Vermont Democratic coordinated campaign." Moreover, Sanders' political advisor Jeff Weaver also told that Sanders' campaign will donate $150,000 to the state's Democratic Party. $150,000 is not a whole lot considering how much he got in donations when he ran for president. Even though he still typically works for the state's Democratic Party post-primary, you'd be wondering why exactly Sanders chose to run in the primary in the first place. Considering his usual plan to decline the nomination, as Politico explained in the May 22nd article, the move is likely strategic. As on that note, Sanders running in the Democratic Party means that it's highly likely that Vermont's Democratic Party would give the nomination to someone else for the general election. Thus, Sanders running in the Democratic primary seemingly protects him from having more competition in the general election. Moreover, Politico also implied that running in the Democratic primary allowed Sanders to gain electoral momentum and popular support, but then still maintains political independence when he declines the nomination. Ahead of this year's primary, Vermont Democratic Party made it pretty clear that they approved of Sanders' plan. According to Politico, the orders passed a resolution back in May to indicate that Sanders was still considered a member of the Democratic Party with the rights and privileges that come with such membership. So I guess they're cool with it, but still, I think I can understand that. Like, if he ran as independent and they nominated another Democrat, then they would kind of split the votes and the Republican candidate would probably win. I get that, but it still seems ridiculous that he's like, it's just it's a song and dance that we know how it's going to end. He runs Democratic, gets the Democratic nominations, turns it down, runs an independent in the election against a Republican candidate, and wins. Or loses, however that goes. But typically he's been winning at least the past few terms. And going to an article that's kind of funny is that Melania Trump, Trump's wife, the First Lady of the United States, speaks at an anti-cyberbullying summit while Donald Trump cyberbullies. The First Lady's focus on the issue has long been the source of mockery given her husband's frequent Twitter attacks. First Lady Melania Trump on Monday addressed a panel on preventing cyberbullying just hours after her husband, President Trump, once again tweeted to pillory special counsel Robert Mueller's investigation. In today's global society, social media is an inevitable part of our children's daily lives. It can be used in many positive ways, can also be destructive and harmful when used incorrectly. Trump said in her opening remarks as she addressed a panel featuring youth activists, social media executives, law enforcement officials, and educators. That is why Be Best chooses to focus on the importance of teaching our next generation how to conduct themselves safely and in a positive manner in an online setting. She added, referring to her initiative on children's issues. Trump also emphasized that children who use social media should be included in conversations about potential solutions. By listening to children's ideas and concerns, I believe adults will be better able to help them navigate this often difficult topic. She said, let's face it, most children are more aware of the benefits and pitfalls of social media than some adults. Yeah, given especially what her husband's doing. Trump's focus on cyberbullying as a part of Be Best has long been the source of criticism and mockery given her husband's regular stream of Twitter attacks. She's aware of the criticism, but will not deter her from doing what she feels is right, the First Lady's spokesman, Stephanie Grisham, said in a statement to reporters. Just hours before the panel, the president took aim at Mueller and his team, calling them a group of angry Democratic thugs. Later Monday morning, Donald Trump again attacked the former CIA director John Brennan, whose security clearance the president revoked last week. He called Brennan, who has frequently criticized the administration, a political hack. Last week, the president referred to his former aide, Omarosa Monigal Newman, once the only African-American woman among the senior White House staff, as a crazed, crying lowlife and that dog. The First Lady's office has operated largely independent from that of the president. Scholars who have studied First Lady said, this is yet another way in which her approach to the role has been radically different from that of her predecessors, whose work typically boosted the administration's policy goals. So it seems like she's going to do her own thing. Whatever her husband does is kind of, not my problem. Even though when your platform is preventing cyberbullying, you think you'd have someone, you'd be having, like, using your husband or using the president example, like, my husband doesn't do this, and I think that's good for the nation. Although, like, her only other argument would be, like, see what my husband's doing? I don't want to see the next generation do that. That's the only thing Case that thinks she has to make. And I think that does it for Poor News for this week. I kind of like the Poor News ring to it. It's a next step. I always felt like the Poor Report, that the and there always caused problems because you never wanted to say it. Poor News is straightforward and the logo's really cool and it looks very similar to another news station out there. But I think that'll do it for this week. This is Poor News. I'll be back in 2 weeks with another episode, and hopefully you enjoyed this one. I'm open to all feedback. You can listen to all of our other shows on the network at journeyintocomics.com or wherever you find all your podcasts. We're all on one feed there. You can check out, there's a show every day of the week, and then a Sunday is a best of, so you can get a taste of what everyone else is doing before you find a show to listen to. We also have a Patreon, so you can get early access to all of our shows, as well as exclusive content. I know Brews with Babes is coming, and there's all their super kind of coming with that. Gala Freddio just launched. You can listen to me on my other shows. Foodies Watching Movies is on hiatus right now. Or not hiatus, it's on a season break. Adulting at Ease I do with my fiance Liz will be coming out next week with a new episode. And Poor Entertainment will be back on Tuesday next week in place of this show, which will be alternating for the foreseeable future. So definitely thank you for listening to that. And as always, have a great week.